It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has released its latest batch of nationwide detention statistics. The data shows ICE arrests in Wisconsin hit new highs in June and July. Since January of 2025, the start of President Trump's second term in office, more than 2,100 people have been detained in the state. In just a bit, we'll hear a reaction to these numbers from Aaron Barbado, director of the Immigrant Justice Center at UW Law School. But first, let's turn to Paul Kiefer, a reporting fellow at Wisconsin Watch, focusing mostly on immigration and data reporting. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start with ICE arrest numbers this summer, how this new round of arrest data compares to what was happening before?
Well, the jump from May to June is pretty dramatic. In May, conservatively, 119 arrests around Wisconsin. In June, that jumps up to 220. And it's still, you know, as of July, also, you know, still over 150. I would note that relative to the spike nationally, that's not a lot. Wisconsin still has the eighth lowest number of arrests per capita in the U.S., but every person arrested in Wisconsin is a person. So, you know, smaller numbers relative to national jump aside, big jump in Wisconsin.
Big jump in Wisconsin. Previously, few people were being arrested that had criminal records in Wisconsin. What do you see happening there?
Over the whole year and a half, about 15% of the people arrested by ICE in Wisconsin had neither a prior criminal conviction, though there are some caveats to that, nor a pending criminal charge. That has the share with no prior conviction has climbed to, you know, in June, it was about 25%. So, in June, less than half, about 45% of arrestees had a prior conviction. So the balance is shifting. Wisconsin arrestees are still more likely to have a prior conviction than the national rate and are still less likely to have no prior convictions or pending charges than sort of the national average. But the June numbers suggest maybe a shift closer towards the national average.
And what about where these arrests are happening? Do you see clusters? Are they happening across the state more uniformly?
Well, 70% of them happened in prisons and jails and in U.S. Marshals offices. So that covers, you know, by and large, the people who are getting picked up with prior convictions or with pending charges are getting passed from state prison, federal prison, local jail custody to ICE, you know, within the walls of the prison or jail. Outside of that, the number of arrests, the quote-unquote non-custodial arrests, which could take place in a courthouse or on the street or in someone's home, are rising, and they nearly matched the number of quote-unquote custodial arrests, the, you know, jails and prison arrests in June. And of those, by far the largest share take place in the Milwaukee metro area. You know, I think everyone maybe read the coverage of the very public street arrests in Milwaukee in late June.
Late June, there is this spike that we see, and that is clustered in southeast Wisconsin.
Yeah, in Milwaukee, in Racine, in Waukesha. And those were unusual in that, you know, up to this point, ICE has rarely conducted daylight street arrests in Wisconsin. But in June, you know, there was a flood of social media footage of officers pulling their targets out of cars, pulling up in their driveways in suburban Milwaukee. That was a departure from the prior year and a half of arrest patterns.
What to me stuck out from your analysis is this 80%, roughly 4 out of 5 people arrested by ICE since President Trump returns to office are no longer in the U.S. They're deported. What stands out to you about that figure?
It often happens really quickly. I mean, I didn't put it in the data visualization, but, you know, we're averaging between a month and a month and a half from arrest to deportation. That isn't always the case. In the story, I noted one example of a man picked up at the Racine Correctional Institution last year who spent 10 months in detention before his ultimate deportation to Somalia. But for the most part, you know, the time from arrest to departure, be it via voluntary departure, which is its own can of worms, or sort of outright removal, can can be a blink of an eye.
Wow. Paul, thank you for the analysis. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Paul Kiefer is a reporting fellow at Wisconsin Watch. He focuses on immigration and data reporting. Now we turn to Aaron Barbado, director of the Immigrant Justice Center at UW Law School. Aaron, welcome back.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So we see this spike in June arrests in Wisconsin, remaining elevated in July. How is this surge in ICE arrests impacting your clients?
It's quite impactful in terms of the number of people that are being affected by the increased ICE enforcement for their need for legal services, but also just how they're able to live their lives here in Wisconsin.
What do you mean by how they live their lives in Wisconsin? What is changing?
Well, from what I've observed, you know, being in this, the number didn't surprise me because we are deep into responding to many of the arrests and also serving the people that are detained here in Wisconsin. But the fear that people have to live with, that they could be picked up off the street without having done anything wrong, just living their lives, going to work, taking their children to school, has been really difficult for our communities and harmful to families that live here in Wisconsin.
And Aaron, the data indicates that some people are being arrested at the DHS field office in downtown Milwaukee, where ICE agents arrest people during mandatory check-ins. What are these check-ins?
So ICE, some people who are in proceedings, so in removal proceedings, they might be able to live in the community while those proceedings are going forward, mm-hmm. because of the backlog in immigration court, many people, it may take a few years for them to get in front of an immigration judge. During that time, they may have to check in with ICE just to confirm that they're still here, they're not a flight risk, they're not, you know, doing anything nefarious. And it used to be just a pretty routine. You would go and you check in and tell, make sure the officer knows your current address and if anything else has changed, like your job or anything like that. But now they've turned it into a time when people are terrified to attend because it doesn't seem to be any sort of rhyme or reason why one person may be detained and another is not. So people go in there quite blind in terms of what is going to happen to them. They could be leaving that day, or they could be leaving and returning to their family, or they could be put in detention and permanently separated from their family.
And by going to these check-ins, they're just trying to stay on top of their immigration proceedings, their immigration paperwork.
Correct. By going to these proceedings, they're following all of the rules and all of the requests that ICE has asked them to do. And so it doesn't make much sense besides to cause fear and to increase the numbers of people that we're detaining.
The data indicating more than half of the people detained from Wisconsin have a criminal record. Some people would say, look, ICE is fulfilling its purpose here. What do you make of that argument?
You know, I think it's an interesting argument. And I think if you look at it from, look at it just on its face, that makes sense. However, I think people, once they would see what we're considering as criminal records, we'd understand that many of these people have not done anything dangerous or not done anything that would make someone uncomfortable. But for example, people without status here in Wisconsin can't obtain driver's licenses. So if they're driving, and we do not have a vast public transit system here in Wisconsin, many people have to drive to work. And they can't drive to work without driving without a license because they can't get one. So I think I would ask people to just really look at the individuals and the increased enforcement that people are facing these days.
Looking at these 80% of those arrested by ICE in Wisconsin since President Trump's return to office, no longer in the U.S. Looking at these deportations, what happens to people after the arrests? Where are they going?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty, seeing that number was really heavy. Mm-hmm. It's recognizing how many people have lost family members or friends in Wisconsin and who have left our community. Once someone's arrested by ICE or transferred into ICE custody, they're generally going to be put into immigrant detention. We have an immigrant detention facility in Dodge County right now, but people may be placed there, but they're often transferred to other places outside of the state, in Kentucky, Indiana, Texas, Louisiana. We've had our clients transferred all over the country without ICE even notifying us when they were going to transfer someone. So oftentimes we are looking for clients for a few days before we know whether they've been unlawfully deported or transferred to another facility that's much further away and we have less access to, which makes representation almost impossible.
I want to land on what detention might mean for someone. We saw that Leon Yang Wei, the Chinese immigrant, die in ICE custody on August 23rd. It's marking the 57th person to die in the care of government since the start of President Trump's second term, and that's according to ICE's detainee death notifications. What are conditions like at detention facilities now?
So the conditions at detention facilities vary based on where you are. Some of the detention facilities can hold thousands of, over 1,000 people. Some of them, have space for much less. But some of the facilities, I recently visited one in Texas that is basically a tent city. They don't have the infrastructure or protection that is humane or safe for people to live in. We constantly hear worries from our clients that aren't getting their medication. We have a client who has diabetes, and she's had really difficult time getting her medication, which is terrifying and unfair and unlawful, in my opinion.
Erin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Erin Barbado is director of the Immigrant Justice Center at the UW Law School. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the Inside Wisconsin politics team digs into issues coming up in the race for governor, including flock cameras, election integrity, and the name of a Great Lake. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Sometimes candidates get to choose their issues. Sometimes the issues choose them. The race for Wisconsin's next governor has gravitated lately to flock cameras, election integrity, and the name of a Great Lake. Our reporters with Inside Wisconsin Politics look at how Republican Tom Tiffany and Democrat David Crawley are navigating the issues and trying to steer the conversation. Joining the discussion are WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer.
So flock cameras, these cameras run by a private company that are used by law enforcement for vehicle surveillance, have been one of those slowly building issues in the U.S. I got to say, I was not terribly aware of them until about April. It seems like they have entered our politics here, though, as we enter September. Zach, where do they fit when it comes to this year's elections?
They are the new issue, and it feels like they're a build-out from the data center argument, this idea of AI, surveillance state, how in control are we of our own destiny, and these really interesting political topics that don't fit into the typical partisan narrative. So they, not only do we have to figure out how do people think about them, but the candidates have to figure out where do we think about these issues? Because they don't fit into the usual pockets where they can say, this is a Republican issue, this is a Democrat issue. They fall across all of them. And the idea that License plate readers, which is essentially what these cameras are, have been around for a long time. Wisconsin doesn't allow them, but many other states do. Red light cameras. People have argued about whether those are fair or not. You can get a ticket in the mail. If you've driven through Illinois and had to pay a toll and worried about the toll camera catching you or your license plate having something on it, those are old issues. But the idea now that some data center can just collect all that and automatically track you without any idea that it's happening, or people can use it for nefarious purposes or outside of a subpoena is bringing it into legal territory. It builds off these questions about how involved should our government be when it comes to these, and where should our politicians stand? And right now what we're seeing is the gubernatorial candidate saying, I need to think real quick where I want to be on this, because this could be the next thing to bite me in the butt in a few weeks if I don't have a strong position that falls in line with where my voters are and independent voters.
So, Anya, where are our candidates on these? And, you know, what kind of political bedfellows are we seeing here?
Yeah, I mean, as Zach said, it doesn't fall into these kind of clear political narratives. And so we are seeing kind of both candidates, much like the data center issue, kind of use this to go after one another. So in particular, Tom Tiffany this week has been trying to call David Crowley Big Brother David Crowley. So first he was data center David Crowley, now he's Big Brother, because of the ways in which Flock was used in Milwaukee County. For his part, David Crowley is now trying to reduce the use of them in Milwaukee County. There's been changes to the policy in Milwaukee City as well. And so both candidates are really trying to kind of leverage people's feelings on both the right and the left sort of against this tool for their own political aims.
And Rich, it strikes me that there is not a really clean line of where conservative stands on this. You know, there's not a Republican position when it comes to Flock cameras. What's the sort of spectrum of where they stand on this?
Yeah, it is surprising because, you know, typically you think of the GOP as you know, lockstep with law enforcement, and law enforcement has been using this technology for homicide investigations, all sorts of things. But we've also seen stories, including two in Milwaukee, situations where officers are using it for personal reasons or just not for what it's intended, unauthorized use. And that is what is part of what's getting people really upset. So on the Republican side, it seems like you've got the more libertarian people who just don't like this idea of surveillance at all. You've got some on in the Republican Party that are saying, look, this is just another tool. It's been around for a long time. They don't understand why it's a big deal right now. And then you've got Tom Tiffany, who's trying to thread that needle. As Anya mentioned, he's been attacking David Crowley, claiming that Crowley is all about these things and is a big supporter of them. Crowley has said they are an important tool, but he said, quote, unchecked surveillance isn't the answer. So that speaks to the limits that the county is putting in place now. And with regard to surveillance, Tiffany's position is kind of interesting. He says he would block state funds going towards shared revenue to local governments. He would essentially say this money can't be used to purchase these types of cameras or these systems until we have a committee, a task force, take a look at it. And that's interesting because in Congress, Tiffany has voted to restore or to continue the FISA surveillance, which is essentially warrantless mass surveillance of cell phone conversations, text messages, electronic communications. And that, back in its days, in the early 2000s, was a very big political issue that's kind of died down somewhat in more recent years.
So we could imagine a different world, right, Rich, where this issue comes up and Tom Tiffany, who's trying to run as this tough-on-crime candidate, and wants to say, let's not be Milwaukee, since he's running against a Milwaukee candidate. You could definitely imagine a world where he's saying, we need to give police every tool that they want to fight crime. Has there been any hint of that in what Tom Tiffany's saying?
Well, he's essentially not saying he's going to take this tool away, but he wants to put more safeguards in place. Just in my social media stream last night, I saw two posts back to back on Twitter, and one was Tiffany calling David Crowley Big Brother Crowley, or, you know, Flock Camera Crowley. And the next post was someone with Tiffany's campaign talking about a third-party ad highlighting the fights and the melee we saw at the state fair, and talking about how Crowley is soft on crime. And it just struck me as kind of ironic, because you're saying he's too supportive of this technologies that law enforcement uses, but also soft on crime. So which is it?
Is there something, Zach, about Wisconsin's politics being sort of a little libertarian that makes this issue different than in other states? I mean, I think about you kind of referenced it there, but there has been a push for years to have red light cameras here, and that has been defeated in the legislature every time. You know, there was a time in the more distant past when there was resistance to giving police the ability to write tickets for not wearing a seatbelt here. Is Wisconsin kind of a unique place when it comes to issues like Flock?
It potentially is. And there's the history that goes about your individual liberties. I remember the motorcycle helmet issue in Wisconsin, being the home of Harley Davidson. You didn't have to wear a helmet in Wisconsin for a long time. And there were debates about whether it was okay to ban the use of cell phones in cars. And there was already laws that covered that. All these things that we've covered at the Capitol over the years. And there is this mentality that we don't go too far or wait to see where other states go first and then figure out if it makes sense for Wisconsin. And there's a lot of independents that just don't like the idea of being watched or being followed. And a lot of these came from like the sci-fi movies that we watched as kids that are now in reality. And it's scary for some people because we've been trained for decades that when these things happen, it's the bad times. And they're happening now, so people are hearing it from both the left and the right that, hey, this isn't what I signed up for, even if it is a tool that has helped law enforcement track down people that have committed crimes. The question is, does it go too far? And in this era of ICE bursting into cities, the question of whether police are going to come through your door, there's been left and right debates over warrantless breaking into apartments to arrest people, then they got the wrong door, and all sorts of things that go beyond this where people are just scared of, hey, what if they get it wrong? I don't trust AI. They can't even repeat my answer into my phone correctly. How are they going to get this right when it comes to arresting someone?
Anya, do we have any evidence that this is going to be an issue that moves people in November? Are people going to be voting on Flock?
You know, I don't know if in the same way that the data center issue is, you know, kind of a rich text of an issue that a lot of people can read many different sort of problems or concerns into. Flock seems a little bit narrower. And so I think it'll be up to the candidates to really try to connect concerns with Flock to other things in order to drive that. So one of the arguments we've seen in other states, because Wisconsin is not the only state kind of grappling with this right now, is that these contracts are very expensive. And so at a time that a lot of communities are really struggling, and certainly a lot of people are really struggling financially, and then your town, you know, maybe can't pave your potholes but has a $10 million Flock contract, that is a connection that I think will register with voters. I'm not sure if this issue in and of itself, just the kind of AI and surveillance aspect, will necessarily sway voters. But as we always say, you only need to sway a few in Wisconsin to win an election.
Sure. I do feel like on something like this, I have to take a step back sometimes because, you know, we're journalists. We see a new issue out there. We don't know how people are going to respond. So exciting, you know, we feel like this must be the next big thing. Marquette had that poll last week asking people about, you know, their most important issues. 5% said data centers, and it was like around 40% or so plus that said the cost of living. So I think the old issues maybe still carry a little bit more weight. We did get some other news this week that feels a little more familiar. There's an investigation CNN reported being launched by the Department of Homeland Security into non-citizen voter fraud in 9 states, including Wisconsin. Rich, tell us about that.
Yeah, so this comes from an internal memo from the federal government that CNN obtained. It listed the states, of course, Wisconsin, also Georgia and Pennsylvania. Those two caught my attention as well, but a number of states included. So this is essentially plans for a big investigation into non-citizen voting, fraudulent voting, ahead of the election. And traditionally, you know, this is what CNN reported. Historically, the Department of Justice doesn't launch these sorts of big announcements right before an election, just as a matter of kind of, it's not a formal policy, but just best practice. Department of Homeland Security doesn't have to follow that, and it's got its own investigative unit that is going to be doing this work. But the backdrop here is that President Donald Trump has been, you know, making these broad claims without any evidence that there was massive voter fraud in 2020, and that was why he lost the election to President Joe Biden. And since then, you know, more recently, we see the U.S. Department of Justice is suing Wisconsin to force the state to turn over sensitive voter registration documents, and they're saying, well, there could be fraud. We need to check, and we're not sure Wisconsin is checking. That's the gist of the argument. And, you know, the DOJ has sued dozens of other states as well. They haven't won a single case. And also the U.S. Postal Service has finalized a policy that would essentially tell its people to not send absentee ballots to people who aren't on these federal lists. That is held up in court right now. But it all serves as kind of this backdrop of what's happening with regard to this latest investigation news reported by CNN.
And Anya, I can't think we've gotten kind of used to hearing about these types of investigations now, even if they don't go anywhere. Is there anything, you know, particularly unusual about this one, though, in terms of who's leading it?
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly, as Rich said, there has been this kind of steady drumbeat since 2020. It's the water that we swim in, is this kind of allegations of election fraud. I think at this point in my sleep, I could type out the list of sort of nonpartisan and partisan investigations that all showed there was no election fraud. But that has not diminished the claims coming from the Trump administration. What makes this so different is that this is DHS. This is like an arm of DHS that normally goes after human traffickers, drug smuggling, this kind of thing. And they are looking into non-citizen voting, which is essentially a thing that does not happen. It is against state law. It's against federal law. But we've been hearing sort of claims around the possibility of this for a long time. Wisconsin has looked to pass a constitutional amendment about this. But now, using this kind of quite militarized, quite intensive arm of the government to go after it, first of all, they don't sort of have to follow DOJ guidance around what you can do around an election. And I'll note, you know, we're less than 2 months out from our election. DOJ has guidance that says don't do really intense investigative things unless you absolutely have to this close to an election because it can chill voting, et cetera. DHS doesn't have to follow any of that. And then meanwhile, as they've been ramping up this action, they've been saying at one point they said that they found 250,000 non-citizens who are registered to vote in four states. And then upon further investigation, they've released 180 ID numbers tied to people. They won't give any more information. So they're kind of just at the very least significantly muddying the waters with a huge amount of resources from the federal government, again, going into these critical midterm elections.
Zach, I don't feel like there's been a November election that goes by when there isn't some election issue that is, you know, tied up in the courts or fought over in the courts or in the court of public opinion. Is this one the big one in the year 2026, or will we forget about this in a few months?
Well, in a few months, it'll still be being brought up because no matter what happens afterwards, someone's going to cry foul. The question is, of all the things that Rich listed off, and there's a lot of different avenues in which the Trump administration is clearly pursuing to push their narrative of false voting or fraud, which, as we must repeat every time, there is no evidence it has ever existed or does exist. It does not change the outcome of any elections anywhere. But that doesn't stop them from putting it out into the public consciousness. And there's is it the Postal Service potentially not delivering ballots? Well, obviously that would have a tremendous impact on voting in Wisconsin. That one seems like the courts are going to hold it up. It seems less likely to come to fruition. We've heard rumors for more than a year that Trump's going to send ICE in around the polls to try and scare voters. It was kind of hand-waved away by a lot of Republicans saying, no, of course, that wouldn't happen. This is America. You know, that's just, you know, people have not wanted to look too deeply into what could happen because it's never happened in American history before. So there are legitimate fears that there could be law enforcement there at certain poll sites in certain swing states, and we can all guess which ones they are, that might influence the outcome of election. The question is, will it actually happen? And then who will be the one crying foul afterwards about what that actually means in deterring voters, literally keeping voters from coming away? But these kind of stories do come up every single cycle. The question is, will we see people with guns outside polls that represent the federal government that scare away voters?
That's a big question. Turning to something completely different and something I definitely did not see coming as we enter this, you know, home stretch of the election. The president renamed a Great Lake, according to an executive order, from Lake Ontario to Lake America. Anya, when that happens, people react to it. Candidates have to react to it. It's expected. What are our candidates saying about the president doing this?
Well, most interestingly is Tom Tiffany, again, a close ally of President Trump. And he essentially said, I don't know that I like this. He said, you know, he sort of turned it into a joke. He said, unless we're changing Lake Michigan to Lake Wisconsin, otherwise, I don't think this is a good idea. And so that allows him to put a little bit of air between himself and President Trump. But on an issue that is not super, from a policy standpoint, not necessarily a super impactful decision. What it is kind of one of these more ostentatious decisions that Trump often likes to make, maybe a distracting kind of moment during a time like this. So it allows Tiffany to put that air between them, but not necessarily on an issue that, you know, is very consequential.
And David Crowley says, oh, come on, this is the one that you picked to differentiate with the president on. Zach, just real quick as we wrap up here, any sense that voters will take note of this in November?
I can't imagine this being the deciding issue for someone in an election, but I'm sure there's one person out of 3 million voters that will say, this is what matters to me most, and they're probably a sailor.
Going after that sailor vote. A crucial demographic in Wisconsin. That's all the time we have for today. This has been Inside Wisconsin Politics.
And that was a roundtable discussion with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer. Wisconsin Today airs the Inside Wisconsin Politics podcast every Friday. You can also download it and watch it at both WPR.org and PBSWisconsin.org. Coming up, meet a Green Bay actor who used his love of foreign languages to get roles in the U.S. and beyond.
Why don't I lean into that? And every time I meet a casting director, I mention that I speak languages and accents. Literally a week after shooting my first bit of footage, I had my first role on General Hospital playing a Russian bad guy named Horvat.
That's next on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a bombastic instrument making its way across UW's campus.
We recently received a question from Elizabeth Renner of Madison. She asked us, through WPR's Wisconsin Project, why are tubas such a prominent part of the UW-Madison band? And why are they so popular in Wisconsin? WPR's Tim Peterson marched right down to the Madison campus to get some answers.
The tuba has a long and deep history in Wisconsin. In the mid-1800s, a lot of Germans immigrated to the area, bringing their music, their refreshments, and their instruments with them. That's according to John Stevens, a longtime tuba performer and composer in Wisconsin. He's also professor emeritus of music at UW-Madison.
The basic German culture of the state, I think, has a lot to do with it. Polka bands, bands and beer, if you will.
But the tuba and polka music really got oompa-pa-ing around the Civil War era. Military band music was popular, with big names in Wisconsin like the Broadhead Brass Band. Fast forward to today. The tuba is still very much alive and well, especially on UW's campus. Looking into the tuba questions made me want to know more about what it's like to be a tuba on Wisconsin football game days.
Before the game, we'll actually parade around the city and go to some of the different places on Regent Street and play right up close to the crowd there.
That's Gabe Kepke. He's a tuba player in the UW Marching Band. The iconic band dates back to 1885, just two decades after the end of the Civil War. It started as a military-style ensemble, a bit smaller than today's group, Another tuba player is Max Collins. He says the band has a protocol for how members are supposed to act in uniform. But as tubas,
we get to mess with people a little bit more. If we see fans in the opposing colors, we kind of just play at their face a little bit.
Then there's the pregame and halftime performances at Camp Randall.
We're so big, you can see the bell from anywhere in a stadium.
That's Joseph Klug, another UW tuba player.
I know other instruments, they have hats with massive plumes on them, and so you can clearly tell whenever they're looking around. For us, it's you can clearly tell if we're facing the wrong way.
Corey Pompey is the UW Marching Band Director and Associate Director of Bands at UW-Madison. He says the notes tubas play are the roots of every chord, the bass lines that everything else the band plays are built on.
It's just an important sound, an important voice in the band that we just have to have.
During game day performances, the tubas assert themselves with a couple of additional antics. One of Kepke's favorites is when the tuba section builds a human pyramid. And in a tradition going back to the 1950s, the tubas famously embark on a march around the field during the second half.
We play a version of On Wisconsin, that's all tuba. We also play a version of You Said It All, that's all tuba. So when we're going around and playing the melody for people, it's like, it makes you feel like a star. It's awesome.
Pompey agrees. Pompey also says he enjoys just being around the tubas. They're fun. They tell jokes. They don't take things too seriously.
I should also note that it's an extremely hard-working group of people, and you have to be in order to carry that heavy instrument around for as long as they do.
And they just have a special bond. Collins says it's something he loves about being a UW tuba.
All 20 of us pretty regularly kind of hang out, so having that many people that you're just close to just because you are really makes it feel like you belong somewhere and really makes you feel like a part of something.
So keep an eye out for this pack of rhinos, as they call themselves, next game day, especially if you're not wearing cardinal red and white.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that piece on tubas in Wisconsin. And that story idea came through WPR's Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News. Actor Hans Obma grew up in Fond du Lac and La Crosse, graduated from UW-Madison, and lives in Green Bay now. His acting career took him to Los Angeles for a while, and he's just back from the debut of his latest role in Wales.
Du hinder min visas, Chigarin. Den kommer fel tid.
Hans struck out in his early efforts to break into acting until he leaned into his second love, learning foreign languages inspired by his high school Spanish teacher. He says learning languages has opened doors for him, not just as an actor, but in making connections wherever he goes. Hans Obma's credits include Better Call Saul and WandaVision. Most recently, he had a recurring role in the Welsh drama Pobl y Cwm, the BBC's longest-running TV soap opera, and he wrote and starred in a short film out this year called Cardigan. He spoke with Rob Ferret.
Now, your career kind of combines two threads, acting, which we'll talk about in a bit, but also languages. And you're good at them, and I'm envious. What got you interested in pursuing foreign languages?
Well, so when I was in high school, I had a fantastic teacher named Julie Prophet, who stated to me that I had a gift for languages. And that was foundational for me. I found that I required affirmation, and that got me swimming. So by the time I graduated high school, I was a Spanish speaker and a French speaker. When I came to UW-Madison, I did both of those and also began studying a bit of German. And then eventually when I moved to Los Angeles, languages became so my bread and butter that it became a daily thing. And I currently speak five languages.
And you've worked some with your languages, I think, as an interpreter at some points and some teaching. But acting, that is the other thread. What got you into taking the plunge to be an actor and to go to LA and give it a shot?
I was in Los Angeles for about 5 years, and I had been attempting everything. I'm a persistent soul, but by the end of those 5 years, I had booked no work, and I sought advice, and fortunately, I received some that was excellent, because there's a lot of people who want to give you advice, so finding the good stuff is a little challenging, but the advice was, become known for excellence at just one thing, and at that point, I did speak French and Spanish and had dabbled in German, and I decided, well, people have always thought Hans Obma was from Germany ever since I was very little. Why don't I lean into that? And every time I meet a casting director, I mention that I speak languages and accents. Literally a week after shooting my first bit of footage, I had my first role on General Hospital playing a Russian bad guy named Horvat.
Right, and you've learned Russian. That's been added to your repertoire?
It has, although my Russian is very basic. I'm very
enough
clear
for
about
an
that.
American audience.
So here's my goal. My goal with languages is to always be eager to speak languages with people. I think that is a big bar to clear. You don't want to be the person who doesn't want people to know they speak a language because they'd be embarrassed by not speaking it. So with French, with Spanish, with German, with Welsh, I'm eager to find people and talk with them as much as possible. With Russian, I'd rather them not know. So.
Well, now you just hit on my obstacle with foreign languages.
Yeah.
One, I'm not that great at them, but I've tried a lot and I know the thing I need to do is talk to people in those languages I'm trying to learn. And oh my God, I talk right for a living and that fills me with fear. How do you suggest people, losers like me, overcome that fear?
Well, the main thing with language is you are right that speaking is how it happens, but that must be paired with the acceptance that I'm going to make mistakes, I'm eager to make mistakes, I will make mistakes, because that is the person that eventually speaks very well. That is where fluency comes from. When a person begins to speak without thinking much about it, that is when a person is able to just do anything, and that comes from being willing to make mistakes and not being concerned about them.
Now, you've mentioned Spanish, French, German, and Russian. Okay, people study those pretty often. Welsh is the
other one.
Okay, what did you just say in Welsh?
I just said, well, I made one small mistake and claimed Welsh was an American language. It is not. Welsh is the Gymraeg is the language of the Welsh. It is a Celtic language, a sister language to Scottish Gaelic as well as to the Irish language, and it is the most widely spoken Celtic language in the world.
And what led you to tackle Welsh?
So, my grandmother, who emigrated to Wisconsin, was originally from Wales. She was not a Welsh speaker, but because of that, when I began writing TV scripts, I incorporated Welsh themes into the project. And over lockdown, I began developing a TV series called A Question of Service, which involves a Wisconsin person who's half Welsh. And as I began developing that series further, I recognized this concept would be much stronger if the main character were a Welsh speaker. Mm-hmm. So I went to Wales with the goal of spending a summer learning basic Welsh. But by the end of the summer, I'd had such a lovely time and started making friends that I decided to take the plunge and go further into it. Now, 3 years in, I'm a Welsh speaker. I'm part of Welsh culture. I'm working on a Welsh TV show.
Now, put a pin in that for a moment. There's a little story behind how your Welsh grandma ended up here in the United States.
It is true. So my grandmother was on a bus from Cardiff to Bryn Mawr, where she was from, and there was a good-looking American GI, this is during World War II, who offered her his seat. And she said, you know what, why don't you come over and have tea with my family? And 2 weeks later, they were married.
All right, now, you've learned Welsh, partly out of respect for that family heritage, partly for that TV project. And now your longest-running booking on TV is not in an English-language TV show. It's in this long-running, I understand, Welsh drama. How did you go from, sure, I'll try learning Welsh, to you're a fixture on Welsh TV all of a sudden?
So after I had been learning Welsh for about a year, I became friends. I was in Cardiff, and I became friends with an actor. His name is Rhys ap Vrever, a fantastic actor who was working on Pabla Kum at the time. He plays bad guys, which I also tend to do, so there was a bit of a connection in that way. And we got along well enough, and he was pleased enough with my Welsh. He's like, why don't we pitch you to my show? And so we came up with two different scenarios where I would maybe play his twin brother or closely aged brother because we look vaguely similar. That did not end up adding up. But a year later, then I met with a producer through a different set of circumstances. And they were pleased enough with my Welsh to say, let me get back to you. Uh-huh. And he had asked me too, like, who are some of the actors on our show that you think are great? And I named one who is Well, arguably the Welsh actress of the generation. Her name is Sarah Lloyd Gregory. And 2 weeks later, he contacted me and said, what do you think of playing her secret husband, who's American, who has gone to prison and learned Welsh on her behalf? And that gave me a lovely soapy story.
We're talking to Wisconsin actor Hans Obma about his love of languages and how they've opened doors for him in life and in his acting career. Now, you, as we're talking, you just recently got back from an event in Wales, a national Eisteddfod? Eisteddfod? Am I saying that right?
You're close. Eisteddfod.
Eisteddfod. I wasn't that close.
Well, everyone says it wrong except for Welsh speakers, so you were good.
Okay, what is that?
So the Eisteddfod is the yearly competition / language festival. So Wales is known for being the land of poets and singers. And every year they chair the prime poet of the year, where they write an absurdly complex poem in the Welsh language, and then they receive a chair. So Eisteddfod means the seating. So they, as in this poet receives a chair. But again, people compete with monologues, people compete in songs. It is how generations of Welsh people become skilled creators. It is also the case that the whole culture comes together of Welsh speakers. So while there, you never know what TV producers you're going to meet. You never know which people are just there watching everything. And there's concerts everywhere. The Eisteddfod, yeah.
And what did you do there?
Well, I did a handful of things. One, I was on a panel with Publicum, this TV show that I've been sharing with you about. I also learned 2 monologues in the Welsh language and competed with a bunch of 20-year-olds to see who would win the Richard Burton Prize. So Richard Burton is arguably the most famous actor over the generations from Wales. And it was crazy. It was the way that I compare it to, it's like if a non-native English speaker were to learn Shakespeare monologues and perform them. It's quite different from a non-native English speaker learning a standard current script and doing it.
As I've mentioned, like if I was trying to ask for directions to the library in another language, I'd have a near panic attack. What was it like being up with presumably some of the most talented young people in Wales?
It is correct.
Competing with them in their language.
Well, for one thing, actually, by the end, I was very eager to pat myself on the back and say, I have been brave, which I think is the standard for how anything can ever happen. A person needs to be brave enough to go and attempt and do something crazy. And I was brave. And I didn't win, and I shouldn't have won. There were lovely, excellent people doing these fantastic monologues that were crushing it. But, I mean, at the end, I was delighted to have gone and swung away and done the thing, and I think that'll be the last time I do it. But it was great. No regrets.
Now, as an actor, you've been to L.A., but now you're basing yourself in Green Bay. You're working on some projects. You've done the TV show in Wales. You did a short there. But you're basing yourself in Green Bay. How is that for you as an actor? Is that something you think is viable?
So the last few years that I was in Los Angeles, I had begun spending summers in Europe. I had gone to France to study French. I had gone to Germany to study Germany. And I had found that I was not experiencing a high level of joy living in Los Angeles. And I started thinking, if I could be anywhere, I would be among my family in Wisconsin. But it took a pandemic to be able to say, I'm going to pull that trigger and go and do that. Mm-hmm. And it has been a complete win. Now, the fear was I would be based in Wisconsin and I would cease to get work anywhere. But that proved not to be true at all. So I work often in Los Angeles, in Atlanta, in New Mexico, now in the UK. Being here has not been a difficulty. Now, occasionally I need to very quickly arrive in Los Angeles, as in sometimes it'll be, please arrive tomorrow or something like that. But it's a small price to pay to get to be in good old Wisconsin.
Hans, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That's Green Bay actor Hans Obma. His most recent role is in Welsh in the long-running soap opera Pobl y Cwm. He spoke with Rob Ferret. Earlier this week, we heard about a shortage of veterinarians in many rural Wisconsin counties and efforts at UW-Madison to connect new vets with those communities. That hit home for a listener named Tammy, who sent us this email. This morning, I was talking to my husband about the difficulty of finding a vet willing to see new patients and the inability to make an appointment with our own vet without waiting weeks. I was happy this was the topic of discussion. Tammy goes on with an idea. Rural primary health care for us has been helped somewhat by utilizing nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. Couldn't veterinarian medicine have their equivalent of a nurse practitioner or PA? Thanks for the email, Tammy. You can always share your thoughts or questions about conversations you hear on the show. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text us at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy and Joe Tarr. Tim Peterson is our managing producer, and Scott Cameron is our executive producer. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.